The subject of my talk today is the mind-body problem, and I'll be starting off by telling you a bit about what René Descartes' view was. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the name, a 17th century philosopher whose views about the relation between the mind and the body came to dominate most of sort of the philosophical thinking about this subject, and it's probably fair to say also came to dominate sort of much scientific and sort of thinking of human beings in general about this. So it kind of makes sense to start with that historical aspect because of the profound influence that Descartes had on all of subsequent philosophy and science. Now, sort of the thesis that I'm going to be defending today is basically the thought that Descartes' influence has actually been rather pernicious and that we should resist many of the assumptions that Descartes makes. But obviously, before I can convince you of that, I have to tell you about what those assumptions are and what it is that Descartes is really doing. So that just by way of giving you a bit of an overview of what I'm going to do. Okay, so the kind of most significant idea that Descartes had, or perhaps the idea that, you know, became most popular and had most of an influence, was his view that the human being is ultimately a composite entity, that the human being is a conjunction between what Descartes calls a mind and a body. And he advances the thesis that mind and body are two completely distinct entities. And he thinks of the mind as a completely immaterial, unitary substance, and of the body as something that is more or less analogous to a physical object. So, I mean, perhaps understandably, given the context of physics in Descartes' time, Descartes was clearly over-impressed by the new methods of physics, and, you know, the thought that you could try and explain everything that goes on in the world by simply talking about matter in motion, that ultimately all the explanations that can be offered can be reduced to that basic idea, and perhaps complex interactions between various bits of matter, but ultimately it all boils down to matter in motion. So for that reason, Descartes thought, and, you know, from a contemporary perspective, that's probably a rather controversial idea. He basically thought that, you know, physical human living bodies are exactly like, you know, ordinary material objects. So there is in principle no distinction in kind between, say, the chairs that you're currently sitting on and, you know, the bodies that all of you have. You know, the body is just a kind of physical object along with all the other physical objects in the universe, and there is no sort of in-kind distinction between them. So you might think, well, you know, that's clearly a bit of a strange notion because, you know, in many ways we're obviously not like physical objects, the most obvious distinction perhaps being that we are self-movers. I mean, we ourselves initiate our movements and actions, whereas, you know, what we ordinarily call physical objects have to be reacted upon to do something. They don't do anything, as it were, by themselves. So that already might give you some reasons for being sceptical about that idea. Obviously, it has, you know, even worse implications, in the sense that Descartes was quite happy to say that animals, for example, are mere machines. He thought, you know, animals are basically just like, you know, tables, chairs, and other physical objects. There's no, in principle, distinction between, say, a cat and a table. Now, what distinguishes us from being mere physical objects is this interesting substance that Descartes calls the mind. So even though, you know, as I've just said, he thinks the body is sort of just like other physical objects, we are obviously not just like other physical objects. But the reason we're not is not because there's anything special about our bodies. Rather, what is special about us is that we all have a mind, which Descartes conceives of as an immaterial thing that, as it were, animates this thing, which would otherwise not really be fundamentally different to an ordinary material object. So in a certain sense, Descartes thinks of human beings as animated machines. I mean, we are just like animals, we're just like sort of, you know, other objects, you know, that can be brought to do certain things. What distinguishes us, what kind of animates this sort of purely physical mass, if you like, is merely this soul, this immaterial substance. Descartes uses mind and soul interchangeably. And that's what's distinctive about us. And Descartes thinks it's an essential feature of the mind that it thinks. So our essence, really, is thinking. Descartes thinks, you know, what is most fundamental to human nature is the fact that we have minds, and, you know, the most essential properties that minds have is to think. And, you know, this mind, as it were, kind of animates the physical bodies that we have, and that's what distinguishes us from animals. And the reason why he thought, as I said, incredibly controversially, I'm sure, for, you know, today's ears, you know, sort of the familiar thought, well, animals don't really think, and for that reason, you know, animals don't have a mind. And if they don't have a mind, given that, you know, Descartes thinks there is no distinction between, you know, sort of living bodies and other physical objects, it simply follows, you know, that animals are just sort of more sophisticated machines, perhaps running some sort of program. But, you know, because they're not really thinking, they're not, you know, they're not creatures that have minds. So that in broad outline is the Cartesian view. Now, you might wonder, I mean, first of all, you know, why does Descartes think that? I mean, what are his reasons? And furthermore, you know, can we make any sense of this view? Well, let's take the first question first. What are Descartes' reasons? Well, I suppose in many ways, you know, the Cartesian view sort of comes naturally out of a particular sort of Christian Augustinian conception. You know, the idea of the soul, that human beings have immaterial souls, is of course, you know, an age-old thought that human beings for some reason seem to find intuitive. So, I mean, Descartes certainly wasn't the first thinker who came up with that idea. But nevertheless, he has sort of particular arguments for why he thinks the soul is distinct. And I'm not going to go into the ins and outs of, you know, all of the reasons why Descartes thinks that, because I'd have to give you a kind of more in-depth analysis of the Meditations on First Philosophy where Descartes lays out his views. But suffice it to say that one reason why he thinks we have minds and these are sort of immaterial substances is because he thinks, I mean, at the end of Meditation 1, where kind of Descartes pursues this project of trying to find certainty, and the way in which he goes about doing this is by thinking, you know, the best way of trying to find things that are absolutely certain is by first chucking out everything that isn't certain. So he comes up with this idea that anything about which there can be the slightest doubt should be you know, considered as a proposition that we are to be sceptical of. He didn't think, you know, that because something is uncertain, it's false, which of course would be a fallacious inference. But he thinks, you know, for the purposes of trying to come, you know, for the purposes of trying to, you know, eventually arrive at secure truths, he thinks the best way of going about that is by doubting everything that isn't certain. So that, if you like, you know, once we find things that survive this incredibly demanding test, we're going to end up with sort of secure foundations for our whole kind of edifice of knowledge. That's sort of the overall strategy that Descartes pursues in the Meditations. And so towards the end of Meditation 1, he's arrived in a state of apparently complete doubt. I mean, he starts by doubting everything, including the existence of his body, the existence of the entire external world, and in order to kind of, you know, get himself to effectively doubt these things, he comes up with this hypothetical scenario, this idea that he might be being deceived by an evil demon who's constantly feeding him, you know, all the ideas and all the perceptions that he seems to have of the external world. But because he's being tricked by this evil demon, the experiences that he has are obviously not necessarily going to be experiences of an actually existing external world, but rather they're being fed to him by this evil demon. Now, again, Descartes isn't saying, you know, this is something that could actually be the case. It's a merely hypothetical thought that he employs in order to, you know, get him to wonder whether he can be certain that anything that he has hitherto believed about, you know, the world around him is actually true. So, you know, unless he finds a way of, you know, trying to rebut this scenario, unless he can show there's good reason to dismiss it, he thinks that for the time being, he has to run with it and to see, you know, what the implications would be, whether anything could survive in such an, as it were, radical, sceptical scenario. And the first truth, I mean, again, some of you, you know, might be familiar with this, the first truth that Descartes thinks he can arrive at is the famous cogito, you know, where Descartes says, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And the reason why he thinks, you know, that that's, as it were, you know, the first truth that he can hang on to, even in this radical sceptical scenario, is because he thinks, well, you know, okay, so I've doubted everything. I'm doubting that I currently have a body. I doubt that there are any external objects, or that what seem to me to be external objects might not be. They might just be figments of my imagination. So I'm as it were, doubting everything that I have so far simply taken for granted. Now, you know, what could possibly survive that sort of doubt? And he thinks, well, one thing that he seems he can't doubt is the fact that he is thinking. So even though he's doubting that he's currently got a body, he nevertheless thinks, you know, it's still true that he is thinking, or at any rate that thinking is going on. And even if, and this is sort of the ingenious move that Descartes makes, and even if the evil demon is deceiving him about everything, and even if he tried to deceive him about the fact that he, Descartes, is thinking, that wouldn't really work. Why not? Well, because even if Descartes were to doubt that he's thinking, that would still be to think, because to doubt that you're thinking is, of course, you know, just sort of meta-level thinking, if you like. It's also a species of thinking, doubting that something is the case. You know, you can't doubt that something is the case if you're not thinking about that thing and entertaining that proposition and so on. So for that reason, Descartes thinks, you know, he's entitled at least to the notion that he is thinking. And so then he thinks, well, okay, you know, what follows from the fact that I'm thinking? Well, it kind of seems intuitive and plausible to think that if there is thinking going on, there must be a thinker. And so, you know, what is, as it were, this thing that thinks? I mean, given that so far he's doubted that there is a world, he's doubting even that he's got a body, all of these things might just be, you know, figments of his imagination that the evil demon is feeding him. So, you know, what is actually left? I mean, what could be the locus of this thought if, you know, if everything is just a chimera, if everything is just a figment of his imagination? And Descartes thinks, well, that kind of shows that even if we call into doubt all these things, like the existence of all these physical objects, including our own bodies, nevertheless, there is thinking going on, and something has to be the subject of that thinking. And so Descartes then draws the conclusion from that he is therefore a thinking thing, And given that that thinking thing that he is cannot be equated with anything physical, because if you recall, he's called into doubt everything physical. And so for that reason, he thinks, you know, he's entitled to the idea that what is doing the thinking is this immaterial mind. And that's the subject of the thoughts he's having. And he sums this up by saying, sum res cogitans, I am a thinking thing. Now, you might already be wondering about how plausible this argument is. Because, I mean, of course, it doesn't follow from the fact that I've doubted all physical things, that I'm therefore entitled to the claim that what is the subject of the thinking that I'm currently aware of, you know, is necessarily some immaterial substance. I mean, that's a huge leap. I mean, you know, maybe our physical bodies are necessary for thinking to be going on. So, I mean, it's one thing, you know, to in the imagination doubt something, but that, of course, doesn't show that whatever it is that I'm doubting is therefore not necessary for some things being the case. So, I mean, Descartes seems to be making a huge leap here from the thought that there is awareness of thinking going on, you know, to the further claim that he's a thinking thing, and, you know, that the essence of him is basically a mind that could in principle be disembodied, that is completely immaterial, and that is just sort of thinking there, sorry, kind of sitting there in some metaphorical sense, you know, constantly thinking to itself. I mean, that just doesn't follow. That's quite a controversial claim. Indeed, you know, most philosophers are even sceptical about whether the cogito itself works, whether Descartes is even entitled to a more minimal sense of, you know, I think, therefore I am, because you might think, you know, if you call into question the existence of anything outside of yourself, you have any right to talk about yourself either. Because, I mean, one of the reasons why we've got, you know, indexicals such as I's, you know, the pronoun I, is, of course, to distinguish ourselves from other beings. There's only an I if there's also another, if there's another person who could also be an I. But in the radical sceptical scenario, that's, you know, there is no such thing. So, you know, is Descartes even allowed, if you like, to distinguish himself from the perceptions that he's having? So, I mean, he's entitled to the thought that, you know, there are perceptions or kind of thinkings going on. But the question is, you know, is he allowed to anything more than that? Because mere thinking or perception going on isn't necessarily going to show that there is a unitary subject there that's doing the thinking or the perceiving. Indeed, the philosopher David Hume, for example, thought that we don't really have any selves, we're just a bundle of perceptions. And, you know, a familiar objection to Hume would be to ask the question, well, if we're just a bundle of perceptions, what ties the bundle? And indeed, I mean, if we're allowed to take for granted the thought that there are other beings out there like us, then it indeed becomes pressing to ask the question, what ties the bundle? Because that is then a question of, you know, where does one person begin and another person leave off? But in the sceptical scenario that Descartes has raised, you know, in principle, there aren't any other beings, or there's only the appearance of other beings. So it doesn't seem that he's even allowed to make this move from, you know, their kind of perceptions going on to there being some unitary consciousness there. That's the subject of those thoughts. But, you know, in a way, whether or not we want to let that pass, Descartes is certainly not entitled to the much stronger claim that I talked about earlier, that he can say that what his essential nature consists in is to be a thinking thing. I mean, that just clearly doesn't follow. So that main reason for Descartes' claim, I'm afraid, is just not really going to work. The other most problematic aspect of the whole Cartesian way of thinking about human beings as this conjunction between mind and body is, of course, the notorious question, how on this picture do mind and body interact in the first place? I mean, how are we going to make sense of this interaction? Because let's just remind ourselves again of, you know, what the basic ingredients are. I mean, Descartes is basically saying we've got an immaterial, unitary substance called the mind or the soul, and that animates a completely physical kind of machine-like thing called the body. And the two are somehow combined. And he makes this rather kind of sweet move and says, mind and body make contact in this place in the brain called the pineal gland. And that's where mind and body interact. Now, why did I say he makes this sweet move? Well, because, the obvious question here is, I mean, how can something physical interact with something immaterial in the first place? And if it's very hard to get one's head round that question, then citing a physical location where the interaction is going on, namely, say, the pineal gland or some other place, doesn't matter, isn't really going to help, because the question is, how can something immaterial and something purely material interact in the first place? Furthermore, I mean, Descartes thinks that the mind, you know, causes things to happen in the body. So, you know, that kind of just accentuates the problem. I mean, how can physical causes, or if you like, physical effects, have an immaterial cause? The immaterial cause being the mind or the will, and Descartes kind of thinks the will is part of the mind, sort of one of the crucial features of the mind. So, you know, in a way, he's thinking of movement, voluntary movement, as a kind of telekinesis. I mean, he seems to think, you know, in the way that, you know, some of these charlatans on TV pretend that they can move, you know, something with their minds simply by thinking about it. Well, that seems to be the model that you know, goes into the Cartesian picture, because, you know, we've got this immaterial thing on Descartes' view, the mind, that somehow manages purely by thinking to move purely physical things, namely, you know, parts of one's own body. And as Descartes himself says, I mean, clearly the connection between mind and body is kind of an intrinsic connection. It's not, you know, it's not a kind of purely contingent connection like there might be, you know, between two distinct physical objects. So, for example, you know, a sailor on a ship is going to know, I mean, if he's a good sailor, he's going to know what to do if something is wrong with the ship, and, you know, he's going to repair it if something is wrong with it. But the sailor doesn't feel anything himself if something goes wrong with the ship. So if the ship is damaged, say, the sailor doesn't feel any pain. But when, as it were, our purely physical receptacles, i.e. our bodies, get damaged, you know, we're not like, you know, sailors on a ship. We feel pain. So, you know, there isn't a kind of external connection between, you know, mind and body in the way that there's a purely external connection between a sailor and the ship. So what Descartes needs to explain is, you know, if you like, how this intermingling between mind and body is possible, which explains what the distinction is between, you know, the case where we do actually feel pain and you know, the case where, you know, it's merely something external that we kind of perceive rationally and do something about, but where we are not personally affected. Mm-hmm. So some explanation must be offered of how, you know, causation between something immaterial and something material is supposed to work. And Descartes himself admits that it's very unclear what sort of account one could offer here. Now, interestingly, as is often the case in philosophy, sometimes, you know, philosophers are very honest about, you know, the fact that there's a major problem with their view and that they can't quite see how to get their heads around it. But nevertheless, they don't seem to think that's reason to abandon the view. And that's quite curious. I mean, you know, this seems such a serious and insuperable problem that one would have thought the rational thing to do would be to rethink, you know, the whole way of thinking about human beings that Descartes has proposed. But he clearly finds this picture of mind and body that he's proposed so intuitive that it doesn't even occur to him, you know, to throw these ideas out, given that he can't offer a satisfactory explanation of how something immaterial is supposed to interact with something purely material. I mean, maybe he thinks, you know, people later on will perhaps come up with something, but, I mean, clearly, you know, this isn't an empirical question about amassing more evidence. Rather, you know, it's a kind of a priori question, an intrinsic question of, you know, how can we so much as make sense of the idea of something immaterial having any effect on something material? I mean, you know, how is the causation even supposed to work there? And, you know, that leads naturally on to the question, how could there be such a thing as an immaterial substance at all? I mean, how can something both be a substance and be immaterial? I mean, what are the criteria of identity, for example, for one immaterial substance that will distinguish it from another immaterial substance? I mean, if it's completely immaterial, it doesn't have any features, it doesn't have any properties. So how do you distinguish one from the other? I mean, this whole way of thinking just raises a whole host of problems that Descartes doesn't really provide any satisfactory answer for. Okay, so what's the upshot of this, and why have philosophers and indeed scientists been so impressed with the Cartesian picture if it has so many holes in it? Well, I think, you know, like I suggested at the beginning of this talk, I think, you know, people just naturally find this idea, you know, that we are kind of animated by something immaterial, perhaps for kind of ancient religious reasons that have, you know, kind of seeped into, you know, a kind of natural human way of looking at things, quite intuitive, and maybe, you know, that's part of what kind of explains the ongoing fascination. So, interestingly, most of the responses to Cartesian dualism, even today, tends to be, you know, to plump for either one of the two dichotomies that Descartes has come up with. So it's not the case that anyone actually accepts Cartesian dualism anymore, I mean, especially the immaterial side of things. But nevertheless, if you like, the duality is alive and well in the sense that, for example, materialists who want to equate the mind with the brain, for example, you know, they ultimately still buy the Cartesian distinction between mind and body. They just think, well, you know, the mind isn't an immaterial thing, rather it's a material thing, namely the brain. But it's not exactly clear whether that's a particularly promising way of thinking either, and I'll just give you three reasons for why that might not be a very promising way of thinking. First of all, you know, we ascribe various psychological attributes, intellectual, psychological attributes to our minds. You know, we say things like we're sad, cheerful, all sorts of things of that sort. It's not clear whether it would make any sense to say, you know, the brain is sad or cheerful. I mean, would that mean its grey matter is drooping or kind of water is coming out of it, so the brain is crying because it's sad? I mean, there doesn't seem to be any kind of sensible way of making that conflation. Furthermore, you know, our psychological discourse has all sorts of normative implications. For example, if I believe something to be the case, then, you know, I'm either right or wrong about that. It's not entirely clear that brain states are either right or wrong. I mean, brain states are not the right sort of thing, you know, to have any kind of normative dimension to be right or wrong. Furthermore, even from a purely scientific perspective, nobody has so far really been able to, you know, give clear-cut criteria of, you know, where one brain state begins and another leaves off. And furthermore, you know, there are no criteria whatsoever that kind of provide a one-to-one mapping between any kind of psychological proposition and, you know, the relevant brain state. In fact, there might not even be any kind of one-to-one correlation. So just to get clear what I'm saying, I'm not saying that, you know, the psychological predicates that we apply to human beings don't have, you know, there aren't, you know, physical causes for them. So, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, the brain plays a causal role in, you know, making possible the ascription of psychological predicates to human beings. But that's not to say that, you know, one can reduce one to the other, or indeed that they're the same. So, you know, that sort of the biology of the brain, if you like, plays an important role in making possible certain psychological phenomena. I think that's undeniable, and it would not make any sense to deny that, but that's not to say that the two things are the same and that it makes sense to speak of one in terms of the other. And so this conflation just doesn't really seem to be a huge improvement on what Descartes is doing, mainly for the reason that perhaps all of these accounts presuppose one, again, perhaps intuitive idea, but one that we should perhaps question. I mean, who is to say that the mind, the word the mind, refers to a single phenomenon in the first place? I mean, maybe there is something wrong with our philosophy of language here. I mean, we are naturally prone to suppose that if we've got a noun in our language, then, you know, that must be referring to some object, you know, an object that stands for the word. And if we can't find such an object, say, in the physical realm, then we're naturally tempted to think, well, then, you know, if it's not something physical, it has to be something immaterial. Perhaps, you know, that's part of Descartes' thinking as well. So, you know, if we think a bit more about that presupposition, then maybe what we should be doing is questioning this whole idea that, you know, the mind is actually referring to a particular object, and we therefore have to locate what that object is. So, you know, if the word the mind doesn't designate a single object, then of course, you know, that just gives you additional reason for thinking, you know, the mind is not the brain, because the mind isn't a thing. Neither is it an immaterial thing. In fact, if you look at the various different ways in which we use the word the mind in English, I mean, there are loads of different uses, none of which, well, I mean, that's an overstatement, not none of which, but many of which aren't easily synthesizable into, you know, one kind of theory of what, you know, the word the mind is doing. I mean, we say things like to make up one's mind, to have a dirty mind, to have a sharp mind, to have an independent mind. I mean, obviously we don't mean any of these things literally as descriptions of some kind of object, either material or immaterial, and we don't think we have to wash our brains if we have dirty minds, or, you know, some such thing. Now, you might think, well, okay, it's obvious that these expressions are metaphorical. Well, but I mean, if they are metaphorical, then, you know, clearly it doesn't seem to be the case that, you know, the mind in such expressions, and, you know, many like them, you know, is the name of some kind of object. So perhaps what we should be doing is going back to a kind of more Aristotelian conception of the human being that thinks of the mind as basically being, you know, shorthand for an array of various intellectual capacities that human beings have. So, you know, maybe the mind isn't referring to one particular object, but, you know, what the various different uses of the word mind have in common is, you know, to refer to the rational powers, to the rational capabilities that human beings have. And, you know, if we think that, then, you know, we're not going to be tempted to want to kind of revive either one side or the other of Cartesian dualism, because, You know, if the mind doesn't name a particular entity, then we don't need to conflate it with either something immaterial or with something purely material. And if we take that route, that, you know, would also be a way of kind of getting away from a question that people get very hung up about, the so-called hard problem of consciousness. You know, the sort of the question, you know, how is it possible for something purely physical to think? Well, you know, in many ways, that is such an obviously Cartesian way of asking the question. Why is it a Cartesian way of asking the question? Well, because it's assuming, along with Descartes, that the physical organism that human beings and animals are, you know, is basically no different from the kind of object, you know, an ordinary material object, you know, things like tables and chairs are. And of course it would be odd, you know, it wouldn't make any sense to say that a table or a chair thinks. But, you know, if we don't start with the idea that human bodies are basically exactly like, you know, physical objects such as tables and chairs, you know, if we don't start with that notion, then we're not going to find the thought, you know, that a living organism has rational capacities that weird. But it's going to seem incredibly weird if you start with the idea that human beings are basically no different from tables and chairs. They just have really weird characteristics, such as thinking, perhaps conceived along Cartesian lines as being a very strange immaterial process. But, you know, if we get away from these ideas, then, you know, all sorts of ways, new ways of looking at that problem are going to become possible that, you know, aren't going to necessarily make us want to, you know, find some object that, you know, talk of the mind or talk of the body corresponds to, and then some of the other problems that are raised precisely because we are thinking along those lines might become less intractable as well.